Black Tuesday. George Bush seems to have won the national presidential election. You're tuned to WZBC in Newton, 90.3 FM. My name's John Grebe. Following Victor Robert Venskis, Expanding Awareness and Lucid Sounds, we bring you Sounds of Dissent. In a moment, we speak with Bob Fitrakis, an attorney who monitored the election in Ohio with the Election Protection Coalition. He discusses how he documented dozens of people leaving because the lines were so long in African-American areas of Ohio. Northeast Ohio was considered a key sector in Ohio, the state that gave George Bush the presidency again in 2004. We'll ask Bob Fitrakis about his experience having monitored elections in El Salvador and having written about and observed the claimed oversampling of African Americans and women that many news outlets claimed initially were the reasons behind the appearance of exit polls showing a lead for Kerry on Election Day. We'll ask why, when exit polls for every other ballot question and political office seemed fairly accurate on Election Day in Ohio and across the country, why the presidential election polls in Ohio, presidential exit polls, I should say, came in under the vote registered by voting machines throughout Ohio. We'll also ask Granny D, Doris Haddock, who ran a campaign for United States Senate in New Hampshire. She received about 30% of the vote to her incumbent opponent's roughly 60%. She waged a campaign refusing to take money from political action committees. We'll hear from Granny D about what it's like to have lost in this most recent election, but to decide to carry on with the work that she's been championing for so long, 93 years old. Andy Stevenson will join us from Black Box Voting to tell us about the effort to make a series of public records requests to obtain the internal computer logs and other documents from individual counties and townships around the country. Susan Truitt, an attorney and editor for a legal publisher and the co-founder of the Citizens Alliance for Secure Elections, will tell us about the Ohio election before Tom Hartman joins us, the author of the new book, Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. Stay tuned to Sounds of Dissent on WZBC in Newton, 90.3 FM. U.S. forces are pounding areas in the outskirts of the rebel-held city of Fallujah, and a major attack is thought to be imminent, the BBC reports this morning. There, Paul Wood said a substantial ground force of Marines left their base just after sunset on Friday. U.S.-led troops had closed all roads in and out of the city. Hours later, in the dead of night, came flashes and sounds of gunfire on the horizon where Fallujah begins. Meanwhile, United Nations Chief Kofi Annan has warned Iraqi and coalition governments against an assault on the Iraqi city of Fallujah. In a letter to the leaders of the U.S., the U.K., and Iraq, Mr. Annan warned that that force risked alienating Iraqis when their support for elections was vital. According to an article in the Agence France-Presse, a Western diplomat who asked not to be identified said all three nations were, quote, furious about Annan's letter. At least 33 people have been killed in car bombs and other attacks in Samarra, north of Baghdad. The attacks, in which more than 48 people were injured, appear to have been well coordinated. Samarra has been cited by the Iraqi government as an example of how they've been able to restore order to areas formerly controlled by rebels. U.S. and Iraqi forces seized control of the Sunni Muslim city in early October. The BBC's Claire Marshall in Baghdad says that on the eve of an attack on Fallujah, events in Samarra seem to demonstrate that it takes more than a large-scale military assault to bring a town fully under control. In The Guardian today, even before Yasser Arafat is declared dead, he is at the center of a dispute over where he will be laid to rest after Israel refused to allow his burial in the holy city of Jerusalem. The Palestinian leader wishes to be interred at one of the most sacred sites in Islam, Haram al-Sharif, inside Jerusalem's old city. But Ariel Sharon told his cabinet he will not permit Arafat to be buried in the old city or anywhere else in greater Jerusalem. Mr. Arafat's family, backed by some Palestinian leaders, wants him interred in the edge of Jerusalem or in Ramallah, where he has mostly lived almost in captivity, since he returned to the West Bank 10 years ago. Israel wants him buried in a refugee camp in Gaza. Bob Fitrakis is our next guest. He writes that a voting machine in Republican Gahanna, Ohio, reports 4,258 votes for George W. Bush when only 638 people cast votes at the New Life Church polling site there. Kerry conceded on November 3rd before some troubling election irregularities had surfaced in Ohio. Investigative reporter Greg Pallast pointed out there are more than 92,000 spoiled ballots in Ohio, mostly in Democratic wards that could easily be hand-counted, 155,000 uncounted provisional ballots, uncounted overseas military ballots, and some uncounted absentee ballots. Despite the comments of Kerry's running mate, Senator John Edwards, that every vote should be counted, Kerry's concession makes that promise unlikely. I'm very glad to welcome to the program Bob Fitrakis. Welcome, Bob Fitrakis.
Glad to be on.
Bob Fitrakis, you're an attorney. You monitored the election with the Election Protection Coalition in Ohio, and you have experience monitoring elections as an international observer in El Salvador. You also had an experience as, was it as a ward chairman in Ohio?
Yes, I was the elected Democratic ward chairman in an African-American ward from 1997 to 2001 till I left the party when I was backing Mr. Nader.
And in your experience in Ohio, how many years have you been voting in Ohio and going to the polls?
I've been voting in Ohio since 1987.
Since 87.
And 17 years, yeah.
I understand that you and some other folks you've been working with went to examine how many voting machines were present in a sampling of the different kinds of polling precincts in Ohio, ranging from the mostly white and affluent, wealthier suburbs and city sections in Ohio to the poorer sections of Ohio, especially African-American sections of Ohio, this crucial state that determined whether John Kerry or George Bush would be sitting in the presidency come Inauguration Day. And what did you see about the difference between those white affluent polling places in Ohio areas and the poorer and mostly African-American polling places?
Well, I was the legal observer in the 55th ward in the 5th war, which is the heart of the Near East side of Columbus, the traditional poorer African-American neighborhoods. And having been a ward person and having run for Congress, a Democratic congressional candidate in 1992, I was well aware of how many machines traditionally were in particularly the 55th ward. Generally, in a primary, you'll get four machines, usually three machines and a provisional or handicap machine. In a general election, you'll get five. Now, what I found is that in seven out of the eight precincts and polling places, the eight polling places I covered, seven of them had three machines. But the third machine was actually a provisional machine that you had to manually convert from electronic voting to punch card, which makes it really kind of two and a half machines. It's almost not worth the trouble. Our observations of the suburban areas, generally we found between 6 and 12 machines at polling sites, 10 machines in Pickerington. What we're now getting, strangely, as part of the breaking news, just yesterday, we're getting reports from people at the Board of Election from a Democratic deputy director that at the last second, the machine location was outsourced to a private company by the county, which I find shocking and massively unacceptable.
What did you observe about the difference between the exit polling in races around Ohio for other political offices beside the presidency that were being voted for and other ballot questions? Were the exit polls fairly accurate compared to the ultimate vote tally?
Well, you're looking at exit polls that seem to be, on average, 5% off. But not surprisingly, they seem to be off in the counties that use electronic voting, which are approximately 14.6 of the votes counted in Ohio, including Franklin County, which uses electronic voting. So what we're finding is that where there's a paper trail you get accurate exit polling, where there's no paper trail, you don't get accurate polling data, and that is consistently outside the margin of error. Margin of error is plus or minus 3 and 95% confidence interval, meaning 95 times out of 100, it'll be plus or minus 3. And oddly also, the initial analysis shows us that the polling seems to be, exit polling seems to be accurate for every issue, every candidate falling within the margin of error except the presidency. We're also getting strange new reports from Warren County that under a terrorist threat, the media was kicked out and the vote count was not watched when the tabulations were coming in. And this is a southwestern county right next to Cincinnati, very Republican. And we had heard before the elections, there had been rumors that if they were going to steal the vote in Ohio, it would happen in Warren County.
Warren County that happened in?
Yes, just south of Dayton and just to the west of Cincinnati. And now we're getting reports from the local media there that they were essentially thrown out. In fact, I was almost reassigned to Warren County with a special sort of shock team who had been lawyers, Ohio State University people, because we had heard reports that the activity, the vote was delayed there for a couple hours in Warren County because of the long lines. And then it really was a huge vote push in Warren County that shifted the vote towards George Bush.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Bob Fitrakis, an attorney. He monitored the election with the Election Protection Coalition. He monitored the election in Ohio. He's been an Ohio voter and gone to the polls himself for over a decade. Bob Fitrakis, you were just talking about the 3% margin of error that most that exit polls have. 99 times out of 100, they're going to be within plus or minus 3% of the final vote tally. You indicated that so far, as far as you can tell, the presidential election, the presidential tally was 4 or 5 points instead of just 3 points off away from the exit polls. And
right.
Do you mean by 4 or 5 points leaning towards George Bush? Is that right?
Yeah, consistently leaning to Bush, consistently in counties with electronic voting machines. And it may simply be, I mean, we've already got the verified fact that if you cast 638 votes, but you end up, president ends up with 39,000 votes, and when only he deserved 360, there may be an explanation for this.
Let me ask you about the voting machines. Go ahead. Were you about to offer an explanation?
No.
Okay.
No.
Let me ask you about the voting machines. Are they all or just some of them made by the Diebold Corporation?
Just some of them. Some of them are made by Sequoia. But all of them, you know, if you look at Popular Science and or Popular Mechanics, all of them are susceptible to hacking. They're susceptible to manipulation. There were famous cases with our machines in Franklin County. When I ran for Congress, I lost the 55th ward, 80-20. That was a software glitch. It's not only the black box itself, but if the software isn't hooked up properly, you push a vote for Fitrakis in the 55th, my home ward, and it goes to the Republican candidate. This also happened to John Kasich in Westerville, his home base. He lost 3% of the vote. Instead of winning 80-20, 90-10, the Democratic candidate, Ed Brown, and this was in an election in 1996, ended up getting the votes. So you not only have to worry about no paper trail, you have to worry about the software, because every machine is rotated since candidates aren't allowed to always be first on the ballot.
Bob Fitrakis, you've obtained a copy of a letter written by the CEO, Chief Executive Officer of the Diebold Corporation, Wally O'Dell. He wrote this letter, as I understand it, if I'm correct, as a fundraising letter for the Republican Party in Ohio. What did he promise in that letter?
He promised, I have the letter, committing to helping deliver Ohio's electoral votes to the president, is what he says. And he's committed to helping deliver Ohio's electoral votes to the president as part of a fundraiser. He's a pioneer. He raised over $100,000 for the president. He's been down to the Crawford Ranch. He's had the house essentially rezoned so he could serve alcohol in a dry area for Republican fundraisers.
I should mention we're talking about a kind of a sensitive issue here about margins of error and electronic voting and exit polls compared with voting results. That you have a PhD in political science and have written statistical analysis that's been published in a refereed journal and received a grant to conduct polling research on other political issues. So I just want to point this out because some of the numbers we're looking at here raise the question about how the exit polls could be just in the presidential elections and not in the elections, not in the votes for office of other candidates for other office and not in the referendum questions off by that factor. And I just wonder, have you had a chance or are all of the numbers really out already to be able to examine all of those other office holders, the votes for the other offices
well,
and ballot questions?
What you're getting is that, I mean, there's some reasonable explanations. Number one is that is essentially the spoilage of ballots in the provisional ballots disproportionately occurred in Democratic areas. So people who went in and cast a provisional ballot and came out and told the poster that, you know, or they thought they had voted, but their ballot was spoiled. And then the unexplained thing will have to be these electronic votes, because it's statistically improbable. And this is a preliminary analysis, but other people, Greg Palast and others, have pointed out that the spoilage of ballots, you know, ballots that needed to be counted by hand if Kerry would have allowed it, and the provisional ballots are overwhelmingly in the Democratic areas. So people could have been coming out saying, I just voted for Kerry, and that would have been true. It's just that their votes may never be counted. I've actually got to excuse myself. I'm supposed to be on the air at another station in 2 minutes.
Bob Petrakis, thank you for your work. Thank you for telling us the story today.
All right. Glad to be on your show. Thanks.
Bob Petrakis also noted that there were in of the polling places he examined, and other people working with him in the Election Protection Coalition examined on Election Day last Tuesday, that there were an average in poorer and African American neighborhoods in Ohio, an average of 4 voting machines in the primary election. In the most recent general election, that number had dropped down to 3, or as he was explaining earlier, 2.5 machines, you might say, because one of those machines was so pitifully malfunctioning that it hardly allowed people to vote. I think this is important just because it has a huge bearing on how long it takes people to vote, on whether a busy person having to take care of their children or get back to work has a chance to vote. What the Election Protection Coalition observed and what Bob Petrakis would be telling us if he had a few more minutes before communicating this to some other radio programs out in Ohio is that in the African American and predominantly poorer Democratic wards, voting times of 2.5 to 4 hours from the time of standing in line to the time of voting were recorded on just 3 voting machines. These are in polling places, the same polling places, where in the last general election, 7 or 8 voting machines were available. This time, only 3. In white affluent areas of Ohio, there were often 10 machines, sometimes 10 machines in one polling place, and the wait time from getting in line to voting ranged from 20 to 32 minutes in the white, affluent, and predominantly Republican areas of Ohio. The Secretary of State of Ohio has been receiving some press attention lately, Secretary of State Blackwell. And Bob Petrakis would tell us that A Republican attorney has indicated to him that Secretary of State of Ohio Blackwell, who happens to be African-American himself, held back 2,000 voting machines months and months ago that could have been dispersed into polling places with fewer or less operable machines. He held back 2,000 voting machines and then sent them to the affluent areas of Ohio. Bob Fitrakis has filed an official complaint with the executive director of the Franklin County Board of Elections in Ohio. He did that despite knowing that the last major job of Dan Schor, the Franklin County Board of Elections executive director, his last major job was as the Franklin County Republican Party executive director. He and Secretary of State Blackwell had also met with President Bush. You're tuned to WZBC in Newton, 90.3 FM. You're tuned to Sounds of Dissent, which we bring you every Saturday from 11 a.m. until 1 p.m. Coming up in just a moment, we'll be on the line just a couple of minutes with Granny D. We'll have a chance to ask this veteran politician, grandmother, and campaigner for democracy, what she thinks about the situation that we're all in. Some have called it Black Tuesday after the election on Tuesday. George W. Bush and his administration in power for another 4 years. I found this interesting recording of George Bush's alleged acceptance speech. You judge for yourself.
We had a long night and a great night. The architect, Carl Rose, turned out, and my brother delivered an historic victory. Carl Rose, the love of my life. The love of my life. Carl Rose, the love of my life. I'm grateful to the enemy of Iraq and Afghanistan, my superb campaign team. I want to thank the enemy for your hard work. I was impressed every day by how hard and how skillful their efforts. They grow in strength and defend their freedom with strength and courage. And delivered an historic victory. They can be proud of their efforts. I want to thank Senator Kerry. He was very gracious. I want to thank you for everything you did to make the calls and get out the vote. And because you did the incredible work, we are celebrating today. There's an old saying, pray for power. Do not pray for tasks, pray for power. Because we have done the hard work, we are entering a season of power. I have spoken. Pray for the United States of America. All our best wishes. A new term is a new opportunity. Pray for the Constitution. Our people have shown resolve and patience in a new Constitution, new powers, and a new justice, a new economy, and shown resolve and patience in a new kind of war. We will fight this war on democracies, and then we'll come home and fight this war on Social Security, on public schools. We will fight this new kind of war on the next generation. I see a great day coming, and my family comes first. I am eager for the work ahead. May God help America. May God help America. God help America. Carl Rose. Carl Rose.
On WZBC in Newton, 90.3 FM, you're tuned to Sounds of Dissent. We'll hear a little bit more of that special new recording based on George Bush's acceptance speech this week. But before we hear more of that, some words of wisdom and inspiration are in order, I think. In January of 1910, in New Hampshire, Doris Granny D. Haddock was born. She later attended Emerson College and was awarded an honorary degree from Emerson College here in Boston in the year 2000. She raised her family during the Great Depression and worked in a shoe factory in Manchester, New Hampshire, for 20 years. After the defeat of Senator McCain and Senator Feingold's first attempt to remove unregulated soft money from campaigns in 1995, Doris Haddock became interested in a campaign reform and led a petition movement. In 1999, on the first of the year at age 89, she began a walk across the entire United States of America to demonstrate her concern for the issue, walking 10 miles each day for 14 months and making speeches along the way. Arriving in Washington, D.C., Granny D was met by 2,200 people representing a variety of reform groups. Several dozen members of Congress walked with her the final miles of that journey. Doris Granny D. Haddock ran for United States Senate in New Hampshire in this most recent election. And welcome to the program, Granny D.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming back. I'm curious just to hear from you. You actually lost your campaign for United States Senate to an incumbent U.S. Senator in New Hampshire. However, New Hampshire swung its vote, a swing state, to Democrat John Kerry. And New Hampshire is a state with a long, long tradition of voting almost always Republican. You've grown up in New Hampshire and lived and worked in New Hampshire for years, and I wonder what kind of a reception you got from your fellow citizens in New Hampshire before and after this election.
My followers are telling me that the reason that we changed from red to blue in New Hampshire this time was because they listened to me, and although they were not able to make me their senator, understanding that I was 94 years old and probably would not be able to stand the rigor of it, I didn't feel that way, of course. I thought I could. But they did recognize what I was saying, and they did vote for me so that it changed from red to blue, which I consider a great compliment, because I am hoping that I was able to make a path for other people who are running for office in this state, running as I did on small amounts of money taken in only from individuals, no PACs, no special interest money, and I felt this way. If I arrived in the Senate, I would be there without any obligations to anyone, whereas our opponent, Mr. Gregg, had received $2.8 million from special interests, and he was in no way able to do for his constituents what I could have done had I made the grade.
Granny D, what was the final vote tally for you and your opponent in the run for United States Senator?
I can't tell you that. I know that I received 37% of...
And had you ever run for elected office in the state of New Hampshire?
No. No, I was only doing it because I wanted to try to prove to others that it could be done. And unfortunately, I did not have the length of time that Mr. Gregg and other people had, because I only started, I started the last of July, when the person who was opposing Mr. Gregg had to retire. So from the race because his campaign manager disappeared in the night with the funds. And they were looking for someone to take up the position, and no one really wanted to do it at that late date. But I offered my services, and the Democratic Committee said, okay, we will support you if you take it on.
So never having run for office in the state of New Hampshire before, you did achieve 37% of the vote. What about the incumbent, Senator Gregg's positions, inspired you to oppose them?
Well, for one thing, the fact that he took $2.8 million from special interests $498,363 was taken from health companies, from pharmaceutical companies, and from medical insurance. Now, we very much want a national health care, and for New Hampshire to have voted for it would mean that Mr. Gregg would not be able to do so, because he has taken this money from such corporations who request that he not let that happen. He is chairman of the health committee in the Senate, and which makes him very viable when lobbyists for the special interests come around. So there he is, having to say no. He said in our debate that we had the most wonderful health care in the country. There have been bandages put on our particular health care, but there has been no special. There we have thousands of people who are still uninsured and do not have health care. Particularly 2 or 3 million children, I understand, which is particularly onerous that the children are not covered.
Granny D, you've had the opportunity to watch far more presidential administrations than I have since you were born in 1910 in Laconia, New Hampshire. I wonder if you could tell us how you see the last 4 years of George Bush, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, John Ashcroft, Douglas Feith, Paul Wolfowitz. What has been your, in addition to Tom Ridge, our Director of Homeland Security, how does this current crop of administration officials compare, in your reckoning, to other presidential administrations?
I think, Mary, maybe the Harding administration was a bit worse. But other than that, I give them a zero. I really feel that we are in great danger of losing our democracy, that we are no longer free to say what we would like to say, particularly Mr. Gregg, because he is so well tied into corporations. I feel our corporations have taken over our country, our special interests, and we are no longer able, for instance, a lot of us are able to cover our insurances for medical purposes. I really feel that we have made a big mistake, and I've judged the far right religious people who have come into the Republican Party to blame for the change change in the voting that we saw this last time. We had a great many young people coming in to vote for the first time, but they were overwhelmed with the far right.
Granny D, in your memory, has there ever been a time when the Christian religious right particularly has been so allied with the Republican Party? Was the Republican Party always the party of God?
Oh, no. No, it was not. It was not. The far right is a new thing in the Republican Party. And I don't think that they know exactly what to do with it. But I think that Mr. Bush is so definitely a part of the far right that we can expect big changes or continued changes and gnawing away at our Bill of Rights and our freedom of speech is becoming more and more dangerous, and a lot of our senators have become quite timid about saying what needs to be said. That's why one of the chief reasons I wanted to win, because I felt if Mr. Bush did win, that I would be a dissenting voice in the Senate in order to try to stop or get in the way of a lot of things that are going to now happen. I think that we are going to, the Patriot Act will be increased. I understand they definitely intend to change Social Security, and then after that, Medicare, Medicaid. Those are all social things that the Medicaid and the Social Security goes way back to Franklin Roosevelt.
Granny, let me ask you about something. We witnessed in this past election a tremendous amount of misinformation. A huge proportion of voters, almost equal to the proportion who voted for George W. Bush, believed that Iraq possesses weapons of mass destruction, even though none were found before the war, none were found during the war, and none have been found since. No weapons of mass destruction have been found. The Bush administration founded its primary claim for justified war, going to war against Iraq, on this one point in particular. Now, they've changed their spin since the war, since no weapons of mass destruction have been found. But I bring this one example up, and there are other examples, because to me it represents successful misinformation and mass popular spreading of misinformation, not spread through popular means, but through television news, the one source where the majority of Americans get their news, from a variety of television stations. But it is television news, not newspapers so much, not the World Wide Web, not news radio, but television news. Television only came into wide popular use in the 1940s and 50s in the United States. Radio existed as a medium of transmission of information and newspapers. And in the 1920s and 30s, I'm just curious, for example, do you remember a much greater diversity of newspapers? Instead of, for example, Boston just having the Boston Globe and the Boston Herald, one of which is now owned by the New York Times, the other of which also controls all of the small local papers. That would be the Herald owning all of the community newspaper corporations, small local papers. Everyone in every suburb listening right now knows that their town's small local paper has in the last 5 to 10 years been bought out under this one conglomerate now. So that's just one example. But I wonder what it was like. What was different? How did people communicate differently? Did they discuss politics and wonder what was going on and seek out information from a greater diversity of sources before World War II?
Well, I'll have to give you an example, because when the Red Sox won the other day, I had reporters here and there, everywhere, calling me up and saying, now you're 94, and the last time the Red Sox won was 1918. Now, how did you feel about it then? And I was astonished that they had not conceived the idea that there was no TV, there was no radio, there was moving silent movies only, and the only way we got our information was by telephone or the paper the next day. And that was very hard. Suddenly people began thinking quite differently. We did have newspapers. We had newspapers everywhere, and they could be trusted. Now, I recently, my sister, who was 18 months younger than I, and not as worldly as I am, said she was going to vote for Bush. And I said, oh, my dear, and began telling her some of the misinformation that was happening in our papers and in our radio. And she said, oh, but Doris, he's the president. A president doesn't lie to you. I said, my dear, I'm sorry to tell you this one does. She said, oh, I don't believe it. I can't believe it. And I said, are you on Social Security as I am? And she said, yes. And I said, well, they're thinking of doing something about that. How do you feel? Oh, she said, they mustn't touch my Social Security. That's what I live on. And I said, you better start reading the papers, dear, and or maybe trying to find out what in the world is going on, because you're being very misinformed. She couldn't believe it, my very own sister. But that is what we are getting, and the people believe their president. And he's not giving us the truth, and he's talking about God has told him what to do, and so they think he's become a prophet, really, that he is a biblical person. And it's so far from the truth that it makes you ill to think that what we're going to have in the next 4 years, especially when you think that there's going to be maybe 3 or 4 new judges on the Supreme Court, and they have a lifetime existence. So this is a very serious problem that we are facing. And I hope that people will stand up and fight for what we know to be right, rather than being a lot of sheep falling behind bleating. I'm so afraid that people will just give up and say, well, if God wants this, that's what we're going to get.
Granny D, and if you're just joining us, we're speaking with Doris Haddock, also known as Granny D, 94 years old. She just completed a run for United States Senate. She had to begin that fight in July when the Democratic opposition dropped out of the race, when someone did away with the campaign money available. Granny D commanded 37% of the vote for United States Senate in the state of New Hampshire on Tuesday. This was never having run a political campaign in New Hampshire before for office. And I'd like to ask you at this point, after you heard the news about George W. Bush having been, well, Karl Rove having claimed to have won the election in Ohio, and John Kerry conceding at 11 o'clock in the morning via Associated Press reporting to George W. Bush, and thereby George W. Bush attaining the presidency again, and there is some remaining question about vote totals, which will not be counted until 11 days after the election, completely in Ohio, but in this rapid fire, instant information, we must know now, society, the election, it seems, cannot, there cannot be any question for more than a day about who wins. In your experience of presidential elections, how long might it take in the early 1900s before most people would find out who had won an election?
Well, you'd get it on the, in the paper the next day. Of course, you remember that a paper came out crediting at the time of Truman's election. He, the paper gave it to his, I think it was Al Smith, giving it, the presidency, giving it to him with great banner headline across the top of the paper.
Was it Dewey Truman, that election?
That was at Truman's second election. Well, his second time that he became president. The first, of course, was when Roosevelt was assassinated. I mean, no, Roosevelt died, and Truman took over. But then when he went to be elected again, they thought Al Smith had received it, but we had the picture in the paper the next day of Truman holding the paper up with a blaze across it, saying Al Smith wins or something like that. And, of course, Truman had gone to bed not knowing whether he had won or not, and in the morning discovered that he had won. That was the closest election, I guess, that there ever was. Except for this one. This one is pretty close.
Yeah, I believe that was Dewey Defeats Truman, which was a headline.
Yeah, I said Al Smith. I'm sorry, it was Dewey.
And I think it came out of Missouri, if I remember correctly. But let me ask you, Granny D, one more thing I think we only have time for here, and that is how you're looking ahead to the next 4 years. What thoughts have you collected in the last several days about how you want to continue the work that you know in your integrity is the most important political work to be carrying on, regardless of the Bush administration having appeared to have won another 4 years in power?
Well, I think we have to keep in mind what America is really supposed to be standing for, and try to and not let it go, and to form groups that have meet-ons and encourage each other to protest anything that needs to be protested, even though we're not successful. At least we will stay alive, and I think that is so important, not to get discouraged, not to put your tail between your legs and run off to Canada. I know there are a lot of people that are thinking of doing that very thing, and I think that they need to stay and fight. If we are going to have continual wars, I know... we need to be here to fight for our young people, to not let this happen. We need to express how we feel. We must not be afraid to speak up and say what must be done, what is wrong that is being done. We must be the loyal opposition, and the loyal opposition is a big one. And if we stay together and continue to let people know what is wrong that's happening, then we will stay alive, and we'll be ready the next time to do something. We really should fight as hard as we can to get the right people into the Supreme Court. That is very essential.
Granny D, your message is stay and fight, among other things.
Yes.
Let me ask you just one more question, because a lot of people wonder if it's too late to get involved. May I ask, how old were you when you began to get actively politically involved?
Well, I started in 1996, was when I first recognized the corruption that was existing. I was 96, I would have been 86 years old. But when I feel that this culture of that we have in this country, that when you're 65, you should go sit down and shut up and not get involved, that your working days are over, you've worked hard enough, and now you don't need to do anything anymore. Just sit around and watch TV and go to the movies and have picnics. That is the time when you need to do something altruistic. Get involved in something that's more important to you than yourself, and you'll live longer, you'll have a more exciting life, and you will have contributed in an altruistic way. Please do it.
Grinny D, thank you so much for joining us today and making your own sounds of dissent.
Thank you. Okay. I think you're being very brave myself.
Thank you for joining us. From New Hampshire today, Doris Haddock, Granny D., 94 years old, who just completed a run against Senator Gregg in New Hampshire. She only had very little notice when, in July, his opponent dropped out of the race, his campaign finance money having disappeared. Granny D. achieved 37% of the vote in New Hampshire, never having run for political office before, and conducting a campaign refusing to accept contributions from political action committees. She began her political active involvement, she says, at 86 years old. You're tuned to Sounds of Dissent on WZBC in Newton, 90.3 FM. Coming up in just a moment, we'll speak with Andy Stevenson. He's the Associate Director of Black Box Voting, a nonpartisan consumer protection organization for elections. We'll find out what Black Box Voting is doing in demanding a series of public records be presented to obtain the internal computer logs and other documents from thousands of individual counties and townships in the last election. You're tuned to WZBC in Newton, 90.3 FM. My name's John Grebe. Tune to this program, The Sounds of Dissent, every Saturday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Canadian immigration officials said the number of U.S. citizens visiting their website went up sixfold the day after the United States election. This report from the BBC today. Canada has a large-scale immigration policy, and Immigration Ministry spokeswoman Maria Iandinardi said Canada would welcome all new applicants. In fact, Canada could find itself attracting more gay couples from the United States after a Saskatchewan court ruled in favor of homosexual marriages on Friday. The Prairie Province joins five other provinces and one territory in Canada by declaring that existing marriage laws discriminate against gay couples and are unconstitutional. Earlier this week, 11 U.S. states voted in referendums to ban gay marriage. In the coming days, millions of Democrats across the United States will struggle to come to terms with defeat. For some, the implications of Mr. Bush's victory are only now beginning to sink in. Joan Bechtold, who works at the University of Minnesota, said, quote, "First, I'm numb. It's like a weight of reality crashing down on me that I'm in a minority and that the rest of the country is uncritical, fooled by hype, fooled by righteousness," end quote. Others lashed out in fury not only at George Bush but at John Kerry, who conceded the election too early in their view and compounded the insult with a call for national unity. Mitch Hampton, a jazz pianist from Boston, said, "This is a symbol of my disunity," tapping on the anti-Bush button on his lapel. "If we want to work together, we have to work with the enemy, and the enemy is in the White House." To Mr. Hampton's mind, reconciliation with the right would destroy an entire way of life. He said, quote, "I'm going to try to fight a cultural war." Incidentally, this quote from Boston jazz pianist comes to us via Suzanne Goldberg, based in Washington, but writing for The Guardian newspaper of England. Tanya Erzin, a recent transplant to Columbus, Ohio, from New York, argues that the left must recapture the territory of moral values, as they're called, from the right, making issues of war, poverty, and health care. She said, "We have to take back that language, otherwise we're going to live in a theocracy in the United States, and that is terrifying." Out of Bangkok, the Interpress Service reports, many Asians were dismayed when they woke up to the news on Thursday morning that George W. Bush had been reelected to a second term. Award-winning Indian author Arundhati Roy could not hide her disbelief. She told reporters, quote, "It is difficult to see why the war was not a major election issue. The sense that that kind of brutality is good, or at the very least acceptable, and in the interests of people, I suppose, is one of the biggest dilemmas that face the world today." Michelle Tan, a 19-year-old Singaporean student, summed up her frustration in these words, Quote, I mean, do the people of the United States really want to be put through more wars, job losses, and deficits? It's so hard to fathom. How can 59 million people be so stupid? End quote. This article from Sony Inbaraj from the Interpress Service, writing out of Bangkok. From Boulder, Colorado, the report yesterday that at least 85 high school students worried about war, a return of the draft, and the future of the environment staged an overnight protest in the Boulder High School library before leaving peacefully Friday morning. The students said they wanted assurances from political leaders about the direction of the country. Representative Mark Udall, Democrat of Colorado, met with some of the students for about an hour after they left the library at 7 a.m. Senior Cameron Ellie Murdoch said, quote, we're worried that in 4 years we're going to be at war with five countries and we're going to have no trees. I know that's an extreme position, but I'm really worried about the draft. Natalie Gott writes in the Associated Press today, the Texas State Board of Education approved new health textbooks for the state's high school and middle school students yesterday after the publishers agreed to change the wording to depict marriage as the union of a man and a woman. On Thursday, a board member said proposed new books ran counter to a Texas law banning the recognition of gay civil unions because the texts used such terms as, quote, married partners instead of, quote, husband and wife. One publisher, McGraw-Hill, changed phrases such as, quote, when two people marry and, quote, partners to, quote, when a man and a woman marry and, quote, husbands and wives. Board member Terry Leo, a Republican, said she was pleased with the publisher's changes. She had led the push to get the publishers to change the texts, objecting to what she called, quote, asexual stealth phrases. Randall Ellis, executive director of the Lesbian Gay Rights Lobby of Texas, said the board overstepped its bounds in suggesting and adopting the new wording. She said their job is to review for factual information, and instead what we see is the insertion of someone's ideology and agenda. This report actually appearing in today's Boston Globe as well, by Natalie Gott of the Associated Press. Finally, The Independent newspaper of England reports today that gay marriage still has its supporters, going by the astonishing performance of a dance track released by 71-year-old Yoko Ono. Every man has a man who loves him has rocketed to the top of the American dance chart, a new version of the song Every Man Has a Woman Who Loves Him, released by John Lennon's widow almost 25 years ago. She said, this is a victory not just for me, but for all Americans who are against the administration's decision to ban gay marriage. This report appearing in today's Independent newspaper out of England. You're tuned to Sounds of Dissent on WZBC in Newton.